Hi everyone, today we have a hit parade episode for you, but we are going to divide them into two separate ones, Massachusetts this week and Rhode Island next week.
I still think this might be a little long.
Oh no, it is not. It is going to be shorter than usual, actually.
Okay, so that means I can do a quick mailbag question.
Okay, what do we got?
David wanted to know about Big Al Bruno and when we were going to be covering him.
Oh, so Springfield, guys. I think that we're going to wait to do that until we get into Willie Grosso and those guys, so probably not to season 3.
Okay. So, now we know.
All right. So the first person slain in 1977 was Louis Aquila, who I knew, but not as well as his brother Jackie, or as well as the man whose apartment Louis was leaving when he was killed in February of 1977.
Have you ever stopped to think how many people you knew who were killed?
No, but I'm quite sure it's more than most. How many people do you know that have been killed?
I actually can't think of any.
Well, there you have it. Okay, back to Louis. I am still surprised that no one has ever suspected Whitey Bulger and company for his murder.
I mean, it makes the most sense. After all, they had a history going back to the 50s through Dottie Barshard and her husband, who was one of Whitey's early bank robbing partners.
And they were in Alcatraz together. Remember that letter that Whitey wrote from Alcatraz that was auctioned off for $600?
Yes, he mentioned Louis in that letter, along with a handful of others, including Don Iannelli from Chicago, who I want to do a little short on because he was incredible.
Do it, but not now. So back to Louis. We covered many of Louis's adventures in season 1, but let's revisit some of them today.
I want to point out that Louis's father killed their mother and then turned the gun on himself, leaving Louis and his two minor brothers, Jackie and Richie, orphaned.
Supposedly the father committed that nightmare in front of the boys.
Oh, such a tragedy. So Louis was born on November 13th, 1930 to Anthony and Violet Aquila, and it was the oldest of the three boys. The family lived in the same neighborhood in Somerville as Dottie Barshard, so you have to assume that's how he knew her. In August of 1949, Anthony Aquila killed his wife and then himself. Louis was already living on his own in Boston since he was 18.
And that fall, he went completely off the rails. He committed 12 robberies, topping it off by robbing 5 guns from Kirkwood Brothers in the North End on a Thursday afternoon in mid-December. He and his partner in crime fled to New York City, but after returning to Boston with empty pockets and checking into a motel room, the clerk got suspicious and called the cops. A search of the room revealed one of the guns that had been stolen a few days earlier, and Louis and his companion were locked up.
He and his accomplice confessed that they were guilty of several robberies, including the holdup of Kirkwood Brothers and one holdup in the West End. When one of the victims failed to identify him in a lineup, Louis stepped forward and said, "Sure, I remember sticking up that guy. Don't you remember? I made you lie down on the floor while I grabbed the dough."
He corrected another store owner who said that Louis and his companion had robbed his place on Parsons Street in Brighton. "Wait a minute, you're wrong. I remember your joint. It's on Brighton Ave." The victim agreed that Louis was right and he had misspoken. Louis was eventually sentenced to 12 to 15 years for the 12 robberies.
Talk about self-inflicted punishment. Louis was paroled in July of 56, but had already been indicted for another robbery in Norton that he'd committed in October with his younger brother Richard, who would later go on to become a reverend. Just before noon on a Thursday, two men wearing a mask, the other with a hood over his head, robbed two bank employees at gunpoint. They parted ways in a wooded area in Norton, with one of the men exiting the getaway vehicle. Someone saw the license plate, which led the police to 20-year-old Richard Aquila, but not Louis.
The feds caught up with Louis and his new partners in crime in Minneapolis in late January of 1957. After their hideout was surrounded, agents carrying submachine guns and clad in armored vests pounded on the door with demands that the occupants surrender. Within a few minutes, Louis and Frank Martin Feeney, both wearing their PJs, backed out of the door, their arms raised in surrender. But one was still holed up inside. In answer to further demands, the ever-lovely Dottie Barshard appeared in the doorway clad in her PJs and weeping.
19-year-old Dottie.
Hey, 19-year-olds in those days are like 35-year-olds today.
True, but still. Hey, you didn't tell your Frank Martin Feeney story.
More like my aunt's Frank story, but we'll skip the personal tales.
Okay. Bail was set at $25,000 each for the men and $20,000 for Dorothy. All three waived their rights to a preliminary hearing, which meant that they'd be extradited to Baltimore for the trial, and there was Dorothy blowing kisses to Louis as he was dragged away. About 30 minutes into the flight the following week, Aquila made a desperate attempt to hijack the plane. He had already attempted to thwart the U.S. Marshals by pretending to trip as they boarded the plane, but was quickly subdued. Louis quipped, "Well, you can't blame a guy for trying."
No, you can't. And Louis made his next attempt when one manacled hand was released so the prisoners could eat lunch. He bolted from his seat, threw the lunch tray in the face of his captor, and lunged for the cockpit, brandishing the small table knife from his tray. But he was thwarted once again, this time by a stewardess who slammed the cockpit door in his face and locked it. Louis was quickly overpowered by two marshals. He said afterwards that he was trying to wreck the radio equipment. Back in Baltimore, the duo, who were once on the FBI's top 10 most wanted list, pled guilty and were sentenced to 25 years in prison each.
Louis was sent to Alcatraz on February 9, 1959, where Whitey Bulger joined him 9 months later. Like Laura said earlier, Whitey and Louis were close in Alcatraz. Feeney wouldn't arrive there for another 3 years, and he and Louis would be some of the last men to leave Alcatraz. And Frank only had to suffer being accosted by your aunt.
"Please, I heard him tell my father after she chased him from the house, 'Your sister is harder than any guy I came up against in Alcatraz. I will never step foot in your house again.' And I don't blame him. She was that bad."
I bet. Well, Louis's end wasn't so lucky, and that brings us to February 1977 and the last day of Louis's life.
So Louis hadn't been out of the can for long. I only remember meeting him a couple of times. His brother Jackie was a close friend of Dad's. My favorite memory of Jackie was the El Camino that he drove around in. For our listeners that don't know what an El Camino is, it's kind of a sedan thing with a flatbed like a pickup truck. And he had a Barco lounger bolted onto the back of that thing. And he worked the carnival circuit, so he had a rest because he had pins in his hips. So he would hop up on the back and sprawl out in the Barco lounger.
But you don't remember why he had the pins in his hips?
No, I want to say that he had them in there from his childhood, like some kind of an accident or something. So he was very duck-footed.
Oh. Well, I'm just imagining a Barco lounger in the back of an El Camino, and I bet that was hilarious.
It was great. And Jackie had a really fantastic sense of humor. He really was a character, and he had this kind of pot belly, and he always had a scally cap and his little curls coming out of the side. I also knew Louis because of my father's driver at that time, who was Johnny Nichols, and that was the apartment that he was leaving at Skyline Drive in Braintree when he was gunned down in the parking lot. A maroon car with a broken taillight was waiting for him when he exited the building. He was cut nearly in half with 4 blasts from a 12-gauge shotgun. The only thing witnesses recalled was hearing a man screaming, "Oh no!"
And like we so often say, no one was ever tried for his murder, but I still think it was Winter Hill.
I agree with you. He must have reached out to Whitey when he got out of the can thinking he could find a way to earn with him. And Whitey or one of them felt that he needed to be taken out. And no one never caught to it when deal time rolled around because either they couldn't remember or it just wasn't enough to sweeten the pot for their deal.
Yeah, I'm leaning toward not remembering, C.B. Fleming.
Yeah, me too.
Anyway, the next murder looked like it was a gangland slaying, so we're including it. And it was that of 29-year-old Jack Monroe. His body was discovered by a passing jogger in Revere on March 24th. He'd been shot in the chest and in the back of the head. Now, there was a warrant out for his arrest at the time of his murder. He'd been involved in a Revere Beach bar fight on March 11th, where an 18-year-old boy named Wayne Bowie had been shot but not killed.
According to eyewitnesses, Monroe, another man named Michael Hannaford, and Bowie had gotten into an argument outside of Billy's dockside around 1 a.m. The dispute resumed inside, and Hannaford pulled out a gun and shot Bowie with what authorities called a small-caliber handgun. Hannaford and Monroe fled, and Bowie was hospitalized. Hannaford was arraigned the same day on charges of assault with intent to murder, but the charges against him were dropped the following month.
A little over 2 years later, Hannaford was charged again, this time with the April 1978 murder of Francis Searle outside of Victor's Lounge in Revere. Searle had been found unconscious by some MDC cops in Revere Beach, bleeding out from multiple stab wounds. They rushed him to the hospital, but by then it was too late. The charges against Hannaford were eventually dropped, and he eventually died in a motorcycle accident in Arizona in October of 1980. And of course, Jack Monroe's murder was never solved.
Are we going to wait to discuss Denny Litwin and Gerald Christie until next week because they were Rhode Island guys?
Yes. So let's fast forward to early November when Robert McFarland was killed by Vincent Federico and Thomas Casale.
Is Federico still kicking?
I think both of those men are still alive.
Okay, so on November 7th, McFarland was shot 5 times in front of 19 Stillman Street in the north end of Boston while he and 2 friends, Walter Hackler and James Theologos, were helping Lynn Russo move. According to witnesses, the trio was being harassed by 2 local guys. A fight ensued and 5 shots rang out. By the time the dust had settled, McFarland was found slumped against the wall. He was pronounced DOA when the ambulance arrived at the Mass General, which is located just a few minutes from where he was shot.
Do you think it was just that simple?
Look, there was a woman involved, and I'm going to sound like a total misogynist here, I guess, but every time there's a woman in the story, it's usually the reason why someone's getting killed in one of these stories. So for 2 hours, Hackler and Theologos were carrying boxes down from the 5th floor apartment. For folks not familiar with those buildings, they're super skinny with narrow stairwells, and the streets really aren't much wider. Sally and Federico were a nuisance, constantly blocking the doorways to both 18 and 20 Stillman Street. And Federico sometimes blocked the path of the duo carrying the boxes and spat on the sidewalk in front of them while McFarland was waiting in the van. Sally also spat on the sidewalk in front of Theologos, and both were busy swearing at the trio.
Lynn Russo stated that she heard Federico tell Theologos, "Do you want to fight?" with Theologos responding, "No," and Russo pleading, "Please, just let us finish packing and leave here in peace." Hackler testified at the trial that Federico said, "You guys think you're tough, you want to fight?" And Theologos again said, "No." At 11:30 in the morning, Casale left towards North Station. Shortly after, he was seen returning with Joe Bruno and 2 others marching in 2x2 formation towards Stillman Street. As they reached the corner of Stillman and North Margin, Federico joined their pack.
Russo was in her kitchen cleaning up when she heard 5 loud sounds. She looked out the kitchen window from where she could have had a clear viewpoint of the playground. She witnessed Casale and Bruno running and Federico standing near an opening in the playground fence. She ran downstairs and saw McFarland lying on the sidewalk bleeding, and Theologos running after Casale and Bruno.
The men were quickly arrested, but in true New England fashion, bail was set. And less than 3 months later, in February, Thomas Casale got into a fight with another boy, Vincent Alexander, and killed him. Casale was arraigned in May on both homicides. Federico and Bruno were still free on $25,000 bail.
Quote, "The system has more holes in it than the Southeast Expressway," end quote. Mike Barnicle wrote in his Boston Globe column dated March 20th, 1978, and I am sure that this was one of the final cases that led to the Bail Reform Act. We'll get more into depth when we discuss the sweep that included the arrests of Jerry Angiulo and Larry Zunino, since it was one of the first times that the authorities tried to retroactively apply it to a previous standing bail.
The trial went ahead eventually, and all 3 men were convicted of murder in the second degree and sentenced to life imprisonment. Bruno was released, but Federico and Casale were not. And we'll come back to Federico next season when we get into the 1989 making ceremony, since he was out on furlough at the time. Okay, and that brings us to the last homicide that we'll cover today, the murder of Giacomo Angelo Jackie DeFronzo on December 11th. And I think we should wait to give Jackie's backstory for when we discuss his brother's murder later this summer.
I agree. So on the evening of Sunday, December 11th, there was a fire at 97 Endicott Street in the North End. It would be several days later before the coroner revealed that Jackie had been shot in the head prior to the fire being set. The building where the fire started was home to 12 people, including 4 small kids.
Now, unlike the majority of the slayings that we cover in these stories, charges were brought against his killers.
And it's really a twisted soap opera. I have to get this clear in my head. Pasquale G. Patsy Baroni was charged in the murder of Jackie, and he was lumped in there because of this broader set of charges. Vinnie Ferrara supposedly had it in for Jackie because he and his brother Joey had ripped off some of Jerry and Julia's card games in the North End prior to Jackie getting killed. The rumor was that the DeFronzo brothers had a nasty drug habit to feed. According to the tale, Jerry directed Ferrara to take care of the DeFronzos. Ferrara then enlisted the help of Peter Lamoli. On the evening of the 11th, Ferrara got in a beef with DeFronzo at the Endicott Street Club and then shot him in the head, followed by Lamoli kicking him in the head. After that, they propped him up in a chair and set the place on fire.
And the aftermath was just as crazy. Anthony Dapper Corleto supposedly swore vengeance on Ferrara for the murder of DeFranzo, which led to Corleto being killed by Ferrara, Lamoli, and Baroni on July 21st, 1979. So we'll get into all of that when we do the hit parade of 79. I also want to mention that McFarland's killers, Federico and Casale, were also with Ferrara, and the DeFranzo brothers were also tight with Gaetano D'Aprizio, who had been found floating in the Boston Harbor the year before on August 7th.
We didn't cover him in the hit parade of 76, but maybe we'll talk more about him when we get into Joey DeFranzo's slaying. The DeFranzos were also nephews of Adolfo Gravellisi, who is a big bookmaker in Boston, through one of his sister-in-laws.
Yes, but I feel like we're heading down a genealogy rabbit hole, so we'll wrap it up for today.
You got yourself a deal there. Okay, thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye.